www.ccr.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, the last of three installments from the annual lecture series entitled The Fascination with Jewish Tales by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight we hear Anti-Semitism, a Disease, Old and New. Professor Wiesel.
This topic is so painful and so urgent, so complex, and so absurd, that to explore it, one unavoidably turns to a master of absurd injustice, Franz Kafka. And his words will be my conclusion tonight. When a Jew is slapped in the face, it is humanity that falls to the ground. In other words, in the final analysis and outcome, anti-Semitism is hurting its Jewish victims, but also others, many others as well. Who doesn't know, if he or she has a sense of history, that anti-Semitism is a social disease and a theological aberration that all decent and intelligent societies are duty-bound to confront, unmask, and eliminate? What is it about anti-Semitism that keeps it alive? Days go and come and go again. Years follow one another. Of all incurable diseases of the 20th century, said Hannah Arendt, only anti-Semitism is still around. Cultures change, as do political systems. Yet the hatred towards Jews remains almost intact. So we try to understand, why is what we call, or some of us call, the oldest collective hate obsession in recorded history still immune to change? What makes it so popular, so attractive, so seductive in so many circles? May I confess to you that in this respect I was naive. I thought it would disappear. I thought that actually the anti-Semites themselves will stop it. And here, I cannot resist telling you an anecdote, a true one, told to me by a man named Meyer Weisgall, who was the founder of the Weizmann Institute, an extraordinary man. He called himself the king of the schnorrers, the king of the beggars. He was the best fundraiser for Israel and for anything really that Jewish culture had, Jewish science. He told me the following story. He said he came once for a fundraising dinner, and he was introduced by the chairperson of that dinner. And the introduction was long, long, still long. Finally, Meyer Weisgall pulled him at his sleeve and said, "Sir, stop." Because he was the next speaker. He said, "Stop." And the speaker said, "I want to. I don't know how." So maybe anti-Semites, I thought, would try at least to stop. But maybe they don't know how. Perhaps we should teach them how. But I was naive. I was naive because I allowed myself to believe in the capacity for reason and self-protection of society at large. In 1945, Immediately after the defeat of Hitler's Germany, I became hopeful, paradoxically very hopeful. Oh, I know it sounds strange, even absurd again, and unreal. If ever a Jew had all the motives in the world to submit to despair, skepticism, cynicism, nihilism, it was then. Victims of hatred and indifference, 6 million men, women, and children had been murdered only because they were Jewish. For them, being had become a crime punishable by death. The House of Israel was in mourning. Entire communities, some 2,000 years old, vanished in a tempest of fire. For the first time in our history, our dead were not buried in cemeteries. Our hearts were their cemeteries. And yet, somehow, deep down in my wounded soul, the orphan I was felt an absurd fate in the future. I said to myself, there are certain lessons the world has learned from what happened. Never again will big nations go to war to conquer and oppress small nations. Never again will children die of starvation and violence. Never again will racism dominate policy. Never again will political fanaticism be an accepted national philosophy. Never again will Jews have to fight anti-Semitism. For now, the whole world knows its nefarious consequences. That was my hope. And before going further, I must open parentheses. First, thank you, Professor Frenkel. Thank you for your introduction, because I can build on it. I can simply try to continue what you began. I have some doubts. First of all, I cannot identify with the anti-Semite. In my books, I cannot identify with the killers. I identify so much with the victims in my novels that I cannot say I in the place of a killer. Therefore, you won't find, let's say, in any of my tales, stories, or novels, a killer who says, I cannot do it for him. And second, about identity, you are so right. Identity is what makes a human being, of course, unique and therefore open to the other person's uniqueness. However, therefore, what Hitler wanted to do really is to deprive us of our identity. That's how it happened, the gradual steps in tragedy. First of all, we lost our nationality. Then we lost our citizenship, which means our right to live among other citizens. And finally, we became numbers. Not even names, just numbers. So yes, identity, of course, is what we all build on. Then I want again to thank, since this is my third and last lecture this year, my marvelous dear colleagues, who are really among the best that not only we have, that many universities have, and my students, who are even better than 3 weeks ago. They are learning so fast. I would like to thank those who arranged these, technically and logistically, these lectures. My assistant, Marta Hauptmann, Jody Anderson and her staff at the All University functions, especially Amy Bottomley, and thanks to the ushers, the president's hosts, and the police department, who assures our security. And these days, we need them more than ever, and we are more grateful than ever. My good colleague and friend, Steve Katz, is someone who works for the Jewish Center, for the Jewish Department, for the Department of Jewish Studies, with commitment and devotion and talent and humor. So to all of you, really, thank you. So my hope has been, therefore, that it would end. It didn't. And hence my question and my anguish. If Auschwitz hasn't cured humankind of anti-Semitism, what can and what will? Its history is old, almost ageless. Actually, it transcends both time and geography, religious and cultures, political theories and social spheres. From Pharaoh in Egypt to Nabuchodonosor in Babylon to Torquemada in Spain to Hitler and Stalin, Jews lived in danger. In ancient Greece and Rome, Jews were accused by pagan historians, including the great Tacitus, of being implacable enemies of mankind. Oh yes, their arguments, old and new, remain the same. And they are so stupid. They are not even original. They just copy themselves again and again. How did a French writer put it? L'antisemitism, disait-il, c'est le socialisme des imbéciles. Antisemitism is the socialism of the imbeciles. Suffering from moral delusions, the anti-Semites have no imagination. They repeat the same accusations, the same threats. They offer the same solutions. Get rid of the Jews by humiliating them in their own eyes. Little did they know that already Paul Valéry, a great poet, told us, the worst that can happen to a person or to a group is to believe what the enemy says of them. We never believed what they said about us. But the anti-Semites continue to believe that. So in truth, I believe, therefore, that they suffer not only from moral impairment, but also from a perversion of their sense of reality. They live in an imaginary world. Otherwise, how could they really believe their own silly propaganda? How can they even conceive of the possibility that normal people would believe their insane theories that Jews, like omnipotent demons, control world economy, world diplomacy, and world strategy? I had once a debate with a great French writer on television. And he, it was before 67, during the 3 weeks before the Six-Day War, and I was worried, you know, most of you are not even born, but I was very worried. We in diaspora were worried. And he said, why are you worried? After all, he said, come on, Jews have such influence. Jews are there. What are you worried about? Finally, I said, you know, I'm convinced that you think that we dominate the world. It's not true. I wish it were. I have a proposition. Give us the world for 100 years. I promise you, when we give it back, it's not going to be worse. My proposal was not accepted, but they believe we do dominate the world. Yes, anti-Semites go on repeating this slander, and they have done so for centuries, going back to antiquity. Listen, Apion in the first century said, I quote him, if Jews are fellow citizens, why don't they worship our gods? He went on accusing Jews of murdering Gentiles and eating them in cruel rituals. In the 3rd century, Philostratus claimed the Jews rebelled not only against Rome, but against all humanity. As for the revered Tacitus, whom already I quoted, he said, Jews are all that we abhor and repudiate. Philo of Alexandria, by the way, he was the uncle of the commander of the 10th Legion that besieged Jerusalem, he related the following episode. Caligula, the mad emperor, was outraged at the Jews for being the only nation in the Roman Empire that refused to place his statue in the temple of Jerusalem. When a delegation of Jewish dignitaries came to meet with him, hoping to assuage his anger, he complained, you are the only people who refuse to recognize my divinity, and you worship a god whose name you don't even dare to pronounce. The Jews replied that they had already brought 3 sacrifices on his behalf to their temple in Jerusalem. He reacted with dismay. He wasn't stupid. He said, yes, you offer sacrifices for me, but not to me. As for Christian anti-Semitism, its roots go back to its liturgy and to the church fathers. Some of them elevated hatred of Jews, to levels of theology, describing us as sons and daughters of the devil. We belong to the devil's synagogue, they said. John Chrysostomus declared the synagogue to be worse than the brothel. He said, Jews know only one thing, to eat, to drink, and to kill. Not only was the Jewish people indicted of this side long ago, but it was also naturally falsely accused of murdering Christian children before Passover to be used for the matzah. And such blood libels were so outrageous and so dangerous, so murderous, that certain popes had to condemn them and stop them. But then, great historical figures of Christendom made their hatred of Jews publicly known. If young Luther was a friend of Jews, old Luther became their enemy. Streicher and Hitler admired him. Raoul Hilberg, the Holocaust historian, in his masterwork, offers convincing proof that many anti-Jewish church laws were directly copied by Nazism's infamous Nuremberg laws. For this, Professor Frenkel, is really what happened there. It was the law to kill Jews. It was the law. And what is also embarrassing, not to a different degree, when the war ended in occupied Germany, the judicial system didn't change. Neither did it in France. The same judges who during the war judged and condemned those who opposed Hitler judged after the war those who had been for Hitler. The same judges. Well, the law that you teach here with your colleagues is so important that its sacredness must again and again be preserved. In those times, there wasn't an era in which a Jewish community somewhere had not been persecuted, humiliated, and/or expelled or driven to death. The reasons invoked, disregarding not only truth but logic, they combined all possible contradictions. To some, we were too rich. To others, we were too poor. Too religious and not enough. Too Jewish and too assimilated. Too learned and too ignorant. Too nationalistic and too universalist. Too rational and irrational, chosen by both God and Satan. Muhammad fought them for refusing to believe in him. Augustine said that if Jews are still around, it is so that Christians could see in them Cain's descendants and their sins. To Hitler, we were all communists, and to Stalin, all millionaires and CIA agents. They were mortal enemies, Hitler and Stalin were, but both had something in common. They hated Jews. The Third Reich was already on its knees, yet Hitler, in his testament, a few days literally before committing suicide, still spoke with his anti-Jewish paranoia. As for Stalin, his last decree was to deport all Jews to Siberia. The barracks were ready to receive them. There are a few here, Russian Jews that I met in Moscow in 1988. Surely they will remember. The decree was there. He died before signing it. Which is a lesson that he must learn, because Stalin hated not only Jews, he hated other minorities as well, as did Hitler. And the lesson is, who hates the Jews too, or the Jews first. Who hates everybody. But hatred is not exclusive. It aims at the humiliation and destruction of so many others. It reminds me of a frightening thought articulated by the celebrated Rabbi Israel of Rizhin. He said that a day will come when all nations will begin hating Jews. They will hate them so much, with such passion and violence, that the Jews will have no choice but to go to the land of their ancestors and then woe to them and woe to us, for it will be the beginning of redemption. But even that is not always true. When I was young in my little town, as in so many other towns, the slogan of the anti-Semite was Jews to Palestine. Jidan to Palestine was all in all kinds of languages. Now the slogan is Jews out of Palestine. Nothing changed except vocabulary. Is it true? Of course, not all nations hate Jews. Not all Christians were our enemies. Not all Muslims hate Israel. We are despised and hated only by the fanatics among them, and the others are afraid to speak up. The anti-Semite is by definition ideologically fanatic and pathologically racist. He passes with ease collective judgments and group condemnation. He decides who has the right to live or to die. In other words, an anti-Semite is someone who has never met me, never heard of me, yet he hates me. He hated me before I was born. And then he hates not only the unborn and the living Jews, but also the dead. Otherwise, how is one to comprehend the too frequent profanation of Jewish cemeteries? In simple terms, does he hate us because he needs scapegoats? Or is it because we are and want to be different? But who isn't? No two human beings are ever the same. Isn't that one of the marvelous miracles in creation? This is what the Talmud says. Does it mean that one is better than the other? That one should humiliate the other? Of course not. It means that human society is essentially pluralistic. That although we are different, we all are the children of God if we believe in God, or simply members of the human race if we make the human race human for all its members. Both amazing and intellectually disturbing is the realization that even renowned writers, thinkers, and artists were infected by the anti-Jewish virus. Richard Wagner and Louis Ferdinand Céline remain inexplicable examples. How could artistic greatness coexist with ferocious racist hatred? About Wagner, we know, who hasn't read his book on Jews in music, filled with hatred for the Jews. In German-occupied Paris, Céline, the author of the great novel, one of the greatest, The Long Journey to the End of Night, complained to the German writer Ernest Jünger, who was an officer in the Wehrmacht in occupied Paris. Céline complained and he protested that German persecution of Jews was too weak, too moderate. What about Hegel? Why did he state, quote, that the great tragedy of the Jewish people cannot but arouse disgust? Ezra Pound, Renoir, Kant, a little bit, and Dostoevsky, they all had something unpleasant, something ugly to say about Jews. And Schopenhauer, who violently denounced what he called the Jewish stink everywhere they are. Why did Schopenhauer accuse the Jews of seeing their homeland only in other Jews? And again, Luther, who in his youth demonstrated extraordinary courage in defying Rome. Why could he produce such anti-Jewish diatribes and curses when he grew old? Listen to the great Voltaire. Quote, "We find in the Jews an ignorant and barbarous people who have long united the most avarice with the most detestable superstition and the most invincible hatred for every people by whom they are tolerated and enriched." Still, he added with magnanimity, "We ought not burn them." Is it that, as the poet William Oden said to his friend, the poet Carl Shapiro, he said, "Well, everybody is anti-Semitic sometime." Only recently, pages of Harry Truman 1947 diaries were discovered in the archives. They include an entry which many of us found perplexing, shocking, upsetting, repulsive. He complained that Henry Morgenthau, Roosevelt's great Treasury Secretary, one of the rare Jews in high office to try to help save Jews from Hitler's final solution, had dared to call him to intercede on behalf of thousands of DPs, displaced persons, all Holocaust survivors, who were aboard the Exodus, the ship made famous by its ill-fated attempt to bring illegal immigrants to Palestine. Caught by the British Navy, they were sent back to Germany. Although they came from France, from Port Book, they were sent to Germany just to humiliate them. So Morgenthau tried to intercede with the president, at least that. Don't send them back to Germany. Listen to what Truman felt about such intervention, and he wrote it twice, two different occasions in his diary. I quote him. He, meaning Morgenthau, had no business whatsoever to call me. The Jews have no sense of proportion, nor do they have any judgment on world affairs. Henry brought 1,000 Jews to New York on a supposedly temporary basis, and they stayed, parenthesis, in Oswego, New York, during the last year of World War II. The Jews are very, very selfish, says Truman. They care not how many Estonians, Finns, Poles, Yugoslavs, or Poles get murdered or mistreated as DPs, as long as the Jews get special treatment. And now listen. Yet, says Truman, when they, the Jews, have power, physical, financial, or political, neither Hitler nor Stalin has anything on them for cruelty or mistreatment of the underdog. These are the impulsive comments and conclusions, the angry thoughts, the handwritten words of Harry Truman, the courageous president who desegregated the army, who fought for Europe's freedom, who wanted to be the first to recognize Israel in 1948. And they worried not about the state of Israel today and the army of Israel today, with its problems of power and security in the territories, but about the people, the Jewish people, in 1947, 2 years after the liberation of the death camps, when the entire people were still in mourning. And he spoke about Jewish power then and comparing them to Stalin and Hitler. Are we dealing with the presidential case of split personality? And if he, of all people, could utter such ugly words, what could we expect from born or born-again racists who are still agitating against Jews and other minorities in the Middle West and the South? I cannot believe that he was an anti-Semite. There was too much greatness and humanity in the man to yield to cheap anti-Semitic tendencies. But then what happened to him? Did he think of what less intelligent and truly hateful anti-Semites could do with his ill-advised and irresponsible aside remarks? How they would interpret them? Max Weber attributes anti-Semitism to the election of the Jewish people, envy, jealousy on the part of other creeds. But then why do agnostics and atheists join them in their hatred? Furthermore, is an agnostic Jew less hated than his or her religious brother or sister? And this question, can a Jew be nasty and say nasty things about Jewish ideas and values? Yes, he can. During the Middle Ages, learned rabbis were forced to take part in disputations with converts who used their knowledge against their own people. Baruch Spinoza wrote terrible things about the God of Israel, whom he called the God of hatred. Is this why he was excommunicated? It's possible. Can a Jew be anti-Semitic? Of course he can. Karl Marx's Jewish question could have been written by Goebbels. He wrote, I quote him, and he was a descendant of a rabbinic family. He wrote that money is the jealous God of Israel, besides which no other God may exist. As for Otto Weininger, he despised all Jews. It is said that he committed suicide simply because he wanted to kill one more Jew. Hitler called him as the only Jew he would have allowed to live. Clearly, anti-Semitism grew and developed throughout the centuries. It was not the same during the Crusades and the Inquisition as in the era of Enlightenment. And surely not the same as during the Nazi period, when neither assimilation nor conversion could save Jews from being massacred in Babi Yar or shipped to Treblinka. Modern anti-Semitism is even more complex. First of all, it emerged even in countries where there are hardly any Jews left, perhaps offering proof that anti-Semitism without Jews is also possible. The anti-Semite doesn't need Jews to hate him. But then, recently, on another level, we witnessed the creation of an unholy alliance of the ultra-right and the ultra-left, especially in Europe, which is often but not always directly linked to vulgar anti-Semitism and disguised anti-Zionism, draped in perverse outbursts against what they call Israel's immorality and illegality. In other words, both extremes wish to delegitimize the Jewish state. The first to accuse Israel of Nazi-like racism was the Soviet propaganda machine. In the early 60s, in wishing to erase, which they always did, the Jewishness of Hitler's Jewish victims, when I went then in 65 to Russia and I saw all the monuments there, even in Kiev, but they never spoke about Jews. They spoke about Russian citizens, about communists, never about Jews. Then the Izvestia compared Moshe Dayan to Adolf Eichmann, obviously forgetting that any analogy is two-sided. If Dayan was like Eichmann, then Eichmann was only like Dayan. I repeat, the methods of the anti-Semite remain the same as is his objective. Old poisonous material is being rehashed. Jews are again accused of usually hypocrisy, egocentricity, vanity, double loyalty, and of inventing Auschwitz with its horrors just to get money from Germany and Switzerland. In truth, therefore, the anti-Semite doesn't care whether he is sound or not. What he wants is to hurt. And he sees Jews everywhere behind every event, every move, every plan. Jews are being held responsible for all that is unjust and painful under the sun. The infamous protocols of the Elders of Zion are being widely distributed and quoted. Does anyone really believe it's slender that Jews aspire to dominate the world? A former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, evidently believes so. He said so in a speech to a gathering of 50-odd Muslim heads of states and government who unashamedly gave him a standing ovation. At mass demonstrations in Europe organized by left-wing and pro-Palestinian groups, indecent shouts of Moro Zhviv, death to the Jews, have been heard. Individuals were yelled at as dirty Jews. Hitler hasn't finished his job. Such hatred was not limited to words alone. Its verbal violence provoked physical assaults, burning of synagogues, cemeteries profanated, swastikas painted on Jewish homes, Jewish children insulted by their classmates. More than 1,000 such anti-Semitic incidents have occurred in 1 year alone in various places in Europe. I have a student here from a certain place in Europe. She has a ring with the Star of David on the ring. She told me when she takes the bus, she must turn the ring around because she is afraid. She's afraid. No, really. In Europe? Now? To such an extent? Physical violence? Will anti-Semitism ever vanish from the world scene and from the human heart? Both Sigmund Freud and Theodor Herzl try to solve the problem it represents. Freud by searching its roots and Herzl by looking for its consequences. To Herzl, anti-Semitism was mainly of a political and social nature, whereas Freud naturally attributed it to psychological and psychopathological aberrations Freud believed antisemitism to be incurable because of its ontological makeup. It exists because in the primitive age of the human family, sons killed their fathers, which meant the murder of the one by the many, hence the guilt feelings of many towards those who still cling to the oneness of God. Herzl was convinced of the opposite after the Dreyfus trial, when he heard Dreyfus, the scenes, the mobs outside, shouting that to the Jews. He said, maybe he comes from an assimilated family. He wasn't religious, was nationalistic, totally assimilated, one of the great journalists of Europe, of Vienna. And he then decided the best thing for Jews is to have a state. And that will eliminate all anti-Semitism. Actually, he could have obtained it. Very few people realize that. When he went to see the Sultan, the head of the Ottoman Empire offered Herzl Palestine for $7 million. They couldn't get it. Had he come to Boston, no. He would have found money here at our university. Now, what is the role of the Middle East conflict in all that? Perhaps this is the moment for me to clarify my position with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. Surely it is due to my upbringing and my past, but I support Israel with all my heart. I support Israel and I love Israel. When Israel lives in joy, when Israel lives in hope, and when Israel goes through distress, I want my joy to be linked to its joy and my sadness to its sadness. And there is so much sadness recently. It's true, I love Israel, but I do not hate its enemies. I simply do not believe that hatred could possess any redemptive aspect or element. I don't believe that. Together with President Bush, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Secretary Powell, and former President Clinton, I share their view that if and when the two peoples reach conditions of true peace, the Palestinians should have their own state, living side by side in peace with Israel, without their children ever being killed on either side, killed in terrorist or counter-terrorist operations. Is it a utopia, a place that doesn't exist? No. I believe it's possible. If Israel could make peace with Germany, don't you think Israel would make peace with the Palestinians too? Only if the Palestinians had, of course, the leadership that would have the courage and the imagination and the desire to make peace and stop the terror killings. I was among those who supported the Oslo Accords. I had high hopes for their implementation. I was present at the White House ceremony on September 13, 1993, watching as hope replaced despair. Yitzhak Rabin was a friend, a close friend. And when I saw him shake hands with Arafat, I felt it's an historic moment. Both spoke of the necessity to end warfare. But I met Rabin 2 weeks before he was assassinated, to my shame, by a Jewish fanatic. And I remember he told me then, I quote Rabin, "In the beginning I saw that Arafat was the solution. Now I see that he is the problem." And now many people realize he is the problem. What went wrong? Sad to say, but paradoxically, although Arabs are Semites, some of their political leaders and writers have turned to anti-Semitism as a weapon against Israel and the Jewish people. And that is wrong, terribly wrong. Perhaps clarity ought to be in order. I do not believe that Islam is anti-Semitic. I don't believe that all Arabs or all Palestinians are. The infamous forgery by the Russian Tsar, by his secret police, called the Protocols of the Zion and so forth, is a bestseller in most Arab lands. Television adaptations were shown in Egypt and Syria. I say it with pain. I don't like to inspire anger at people, but the truth must be told. In those places, children are taught to hate, and when they speak of hate, they say, hate not Israel, hate the Jews. They understand how closely we are linked one to another. A 30-part TV series titled Al-Shatat, or Diaspora, has been programmed to be broadcast during the Ramadan, which is now, by the Hezbollah satellite Al-Manar. The series are about a global Jewish government, quote-unquote, whose goal is world domination. And listen to its introduction. I quote the introduction, verbatim. 2,000 years ago, the Jewish sages established a global government aimed at ruling the world, subjugating it to the precepts of the Talmud, and segregating the Jews completely from the other peoples. Then the Jews turned to inciting wars and internal strife. They falsely presented themselves as persecuted and waited for their savior, the Messiah, who would complete the vengeance upon the Gentiles their God had begun. That goes to millions and millions and millions of men, women, and children in the Arab world. In his book on Israel, quote, a state created by intelligence services, unquote, dedicated to his son Saif al-Din, the Egyptian writer Tarek Fuzi says the following, I quote him again, I offer you this volume so that you learn, my son, when you grow up, to hate the Jews as your father does. And maybe you will be lucky enough to understand that your hatred is an honor to which they are worthy. Well, the same propaganda includes the word go and kill the Jews. So what do we do? Does it mean that only their propaganda reaches non-Semites as well, non-Muslims? An Oxford professor, Tom Paulin, did not hesitate to call the Jews in the territories Nazis. And the British writer A.N. Wilson defended him, quote, I have reluctantly concluded that Israel has no longer the right to exist. Such words are anti-Semitic. What does it really mean? It's a call to genocide. If they say Israel has no right to exist, that means to eliminate Israel. Now, isn't this the official policy of Palestinian terror groups such as Hamas, Jihad, and Al-Aqsa? Don't they publicly, officially declare that the entire land of Palestine is theirs? Now, how can we allow that to happen? I say here what I said already last week. Let the moderate Palestinians shake themselves up with our help and our support, and decide once and for all that Israel will not go away. And therefore, there should be a peace accord of respect and mutual cooperation. And that can happen only when they decide that the end does not justify all means, and the killing of children is an aberration of idealism in any of its forms. That can happen only when what we call suicide terrorism stops. I belong to a generation that has endured 1,000 ways of dying, but not of living. And we, some of us who went through that period, we have antennas, built-in early warning systems. We know when humanity is in mortal danger. Once upon a time, when at war, only soldiers on the front line were in danger. Civilians in their homes, students at school, children in their cribs or in gardens in bloom were meant to remain unharmed. Later, beginning with the Second World War, civilian homes were destroyed and their inhabitants killed from air attacks. But today, every city can become front line. Every street a battlefield, every person a corpse. We are all in peril, many dwell in fear. Fear is what theoreticians and practitioners of terror are eager to inspire wherever democracy appeals to the humanity of the human being. And solidarity of faith must be our answer to their glorification and globalization of fear. For what we have already learned in recent years is that the noble idea of globalization has also penetrated the underworld of terrorists. When they attack a hotel in Asia, an embassy in Jordan, a ship in Africa, or now hotels in Baghdad or in Riyadh, and innocent children in Jerusalem, the terrorists want us to go on believing that all of us, everywhere, are in their hands, that they are our masters, for we are their targets. An ultimate aberration of ideology or religion, terrorism has always been philosophically indefensible, morally repulsive, and humanly obscene, for it means the brutal rule of the few over the many. Believers in terror begin by using it as a means to attain a goal, but at the end it becomes a goal in itself. And so here and there, small groups of excited militants would decide that they will move history in a different direction because they simply know better than anyone else what is good for their people and all people. But if such an arrogant line of thinking is contrary to whatever civilized nations and individuals believe in, suicide terror is more so. Just as in warfare there are lines neither side may cross with impunity. But this is what terrorism is doing. Servants of death. Suicide killers are killers. Killers of innocent human beings. Killers of the very concept of innocence. To claim that they obey God's will is making God their accomplice. A notion that no religious tradition would now espouse or condone. And if we want to eradicate terrorism, we must understand its causes. They are not only religious in their orientation. In Europe in the late 60s, they were politically motivated. Social conditions have their effect on the terrorist psyche. Poverty, misery, hunger, helplessness, hopelessness, romantic idealism of national pride, and of course blind and blinding fanaticism. In all of its forms, all these do contribute to a youngster's decision to give up on improvement by any means other than terrorism. Is that what explains mothers, mothers who forget their maternal instinct of compassion, and when one of their sons becomes a suicide murderer, she says she has four more to give to martyrdom. What is the meaning of terror? It's, among others, an upside-down pyramid, using absolute force to impose its implacable will, and under its reign of limitless fear, it operates on more than one level for more than one reason. Yet its goal remains the same, to reduce the other to the state of slave or object. Under terrorist rule, the human being is no longer a unique creature endowed with identity, a creature with infinite possibilities, thus endowed with a variety of choices and options. That is why, even if one may wish to understand terrorists and their murderous activities, nothing can justify them, especially since, unlike their distant predecessors of the last years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th, the nihilists, the anarchists, and other revolutionaries who would target political leaders but never assassinate children, these terrorists today attack anonymous men, women, young and old, all defenseless, all innocent, and they die only because they happen to be there. Heartless cowards, that's what terrorists are. They attack people, anyone. And most victims have done nothing against these terrorists, personally or professionally. Many of them weren't even involved in political affairs. And yet these pitiless, senseless, soulless aggressors will maim them and slaughter them. They are ready to die in the process, so what? The death itself is the work of cowards, They don't seek suicide. They seek murder. They are ready to kill themselves in order to better kill others, and the more the better. What should we do? I believe that this is something which I'm working on now. Somehow we should declare that suicide terrorism is a crime against humanity. I've proposed it to a conference we had in New York not long ago. We had 20 heads of states who came to that conference. Many of them accepted my idea. Problem now is really, this is for your law faculty, law school. Definitions. When does an assassin become a terrorist? When does a terrorist become a suicide terrorist? And therefore, subject to the law of crimes against humanity. One thing I want to tell you, once we have these definitions, we can push it through and adopted by the United Nations. And then crimes against humanity is a serious business. It will not stop the murderer, but it will stop all those who help them. So terrorism, of course, is based on and rooted in hatred. And such is the somber reality of hatred. It's like a cancer that goes from limb to limb, from person to person, from community to community. If not stopped, it could and would destroy villages and cities, both near and far. That is why I believe in the importance, in the urgency of fighting anti-Semitism wherever it is and whatever form it takes to express its hatred. Hatred of Jews must be denounced not only for our sake, but also for the sake of our children and their friends who are not Jewish, for all the others. As is the case with any organized prejudice and bigotry, it ultimately reflects on the nation in which it grows. And there you were right, Tamar. It becomes a moral barometer. For history has taught us, you want to know what a nation does, you want to know its state of health, look at that nation, how it deals with anti-Semitism or racism for that reason. What it does to strangers, what it does to minorities. A nation is defined by its attitude to the weak, to the sick, to the young, to the old, to the other. What then is the answer to hatred in general and to anti-Semitism in particular? Whatever the answer is, education is its major component. Is it sufficient? Haven't we learned that many of the SS killers had college degrees? So I suggest we come back to the question raised earlier. If Auschwitz did not put an end to anti-Semitism, racism and hatred, what can and what will? In many of Kafka's writings, there is the character of the messenger who tries to deliver a message and cannot. Is that his tragedy? No. There is something worse. The messenger lost his message and cannot find it. Tragic as his condition is, there is something even worse. The messenger forgot that he is a messenger. Still, there is something even worse. The messenger forgot who gave him the message. Nothing can be more tragic than that. The messenger forgot to whom he was supposed to deliver the message. Is that the end of all possible situations reflecting his tragedy? No. The messenger's ultimate tragedy is that he delivered the message in time and nothing happened. Aren't we all messengers? Haven't we for centuries tried to deliver the message? Why hasn't it been received? Born in hatred against Israel and America, suicide terrorism has spread to other areas as well. We open the newspaper every day and we see it. If not stopped, who knows what its next target will be. In a novel called The Oath, describing a pogrom in Eastern Europe, the mob sets a fire to the Jewish quarter, and this is what happens. I shall read to you the last passage. The town, in consuming itself, was telling a timeless story for the last time, and there was nobody to listen. Yidl no longer smiles and Avram no longer thinks. Whom are we fighting now? Shaike was asked, but he was already dead. The book, said my father. The cherem, said Moshe. It's my fault, but I was hungry, said Lazer the fat. Memory, insisted my father. Everything is in memory. Silence, Moshe corrected him. Everything is in silence. And the protagonist who tells the story, the first person, says, I was stepping back and back, but the distance remained unchanged. The prey of death, the price of life, Kolvilag, the name of the village, was burning, and I watched it burn. The house of study, the trees and the walls, whipped by fire and wind. The cobblestones shattered. The Jewish quarter, the churches and the schools, the store and the warehouses. Yellow and red, orange and purple flames escaped from them, only to return at once. The shelter and the orphanage, the tavern and the synagogue joined by a bridge of fire. The cemetery was burning, the police station was burning, the cribs were burning, the library was burning. On that night, man's work yielded to the power and judgment of the fire. And suddenly I understood with every fiber of my being why I was shuddering at a vision of horror. I had just glimpsed the future. Well, it will not be the future. It all depends. The choice is always ours. Until next year, thank you.
Just heard the last of three lectures in the annual series The Fascination with Jewish Tales by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was entitled Anti-Semitism, a Disease, Old and New. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti and Matt Largy, with help from Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow, tune in at noon to WBUR's News Magazine, Here and Now. We'll have the latest news and President Bush's controversial trip to London. And why are women so increasingly successful at running construction businesses? And the art of the jazz bass, the propulsive melodic genius of two very different masters. I'm Bill Delaney. Join Robin Young and me for Here and Now. Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is WBUR. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. Donate your unwanted used automobile.